Okay. So, yeah, the title of my talk is The Unconditioned, or The Goal of the Spiritual Life. And I'd like to start by just asking you why you're here tonight at all. We could be at the theatre, we could be at the cinema, we could be at home watching TV, down the pub, soaking in the bath. There are lots of things we could be doing instead of being here tonight. So why are we here? And why are we practicing Buddhism at all? What do we think it's going to do for us? Where is it going to get us? What's our goal? So are we practicing Buddhism as a way to happiness in life? As an escape from the negative mental states that make us unhappy? Or are we going for a greater prize? Are we going for enlightenment? Or are we really a bit fuzzy about what we're going for at all? Well, we need to be clear, because one of those goals is worldly and the other one is a spiritual goal. The worldly goal is actually fair enough, but it won't take us all that far. It'll probably take us to more contentment or happiness in the short term, but it is limited because it won't in the end stop us from suffering. It won't prevent us from dying, and it won't prevent us from losing people who are very important to us. But the fact is that the big goal is very, very difficult to see. We're probably not sure really what it is. We might be a bit sceptical about it. We might even find it a bit scary. So do we dare to believe that enlightenment is possible? Tonight's text, the Udana, actually gives us a glimpse from the Buddha's own mouth of the goal of the spiritual life. And the handout that you've got is just a section from the Udana, and I'll explain it more when we get to it, as it were. So the Udana, I've got two copies of it here. One is in a red-bound Pali text canon series, and the other one is part of the Udana, selections from the Udana, in a much smaller, more accessible and poetic form. And I'll explain a little bit about them later. The Udana is actually one of the most important Pali canon texts, partly because it's one of the earliest, and it's considered to have the authentic ring of the Buddha's voice. But it's particularly important because it gives some of the Buddha's teachings that just aren't mentioned anywhere else. Some of us have heard one or two Udana tales already earlier in this series of talks. You might remember the story of Meghia about spiritual friendship. Some of you actually might remember the more memorable story of Nanda and the dove-footed nymphs. Anyone remember that? Yes, there's some smiles there. Okay, well, they're both stories from the Udana. It's 80 short verses, and the verses are what you get in this little book, and they're interspersed with prose. So the longer version has got all of the verses and then the prose stories and kind of connecting pieces as well. It's thought that actually originally the two were separate. There was a series of poems or verses, and then there were the stories, and that they were combined later. But the verses are the really unique part. That's what the name refers to, because Udana means expiration, kind of breathing out, or something that is uttered under emotional force. So in this context, we can think of the Udana as containing the inspired utterances of the Buddha. So the 80 verses are very varied. They can be divided roughly into a number of themes. And I'm going to concentrate on the verses in the eighth or final section, which is on the theme of the unconditioned. And this is a particularly important text because in it the Buddha does something that he often refuses to do elsewhere, which is to give a description of the goal of the spiritual life. Okay, so what's this about the unconditioned? So those of us who've been coming to Sangha night for the last few weeks have heard quite a bit about the conditioned, okay? Does the conditioned sound familiar? Last week we talked about conditioned co-production, yeah? And I know that the people from the follow-on course have covered this, though the phrase, the conditioned, actually might not sound that familiar. But you've covered a lot of the territory, so don't worry about it if you're new. Basically, the conditioned is everything we know. Everything we know comes into being as the result of conditions. And eventually, it ceases as the result of conditions. Vidanya helped us to dive deeper into that last week when he talked about conditioned co-production. And there is an important list of three characteristics of the conditioned, or of life as we know it, that will probably sound familiar when I read them out, even to the people from the who've just come from the follow-on course. And those three things are unsatisfactoriness, or dukkha, impermanence, or anicca, and lack of selfhood, or anatman. Anyone never heard that list before? Okay, most people have. Good. So, if the conditioned is life as we know it, constantly changing, impermanent and unsatisfactory, the unconditioned is the state we reach if we manage to see through conditioned existence and to reach a state beyond that. Okay, so that's the unconditioned. And that is the goal of the spiritual life. Buddhists have got many terms for this goal. The one we use most often, I think, in the FWBO is enlightenment. But later on in this talk, I'm going to look at some of the others as well. There's a whole long, long string of different terms. So, the goal of this, of Buddhist practice is enlightenment or the unconditioned. But what do we think it is? Is it a blissful, dreamy state? Is it lying around in a blue sky with devas and bodhisattvas for company? Is it our world, just as we know it, but without the suffering? What we tend to do is to think of enlightenment as either a modification of this world or another world beyond, as either something or nothing. And that's because we can't really think outside of our own experience. And the problem is precisely that enlightenment is beyond anything we've experienced. So there are many instances in the Pali Canon when the Buddha is asked about enlightenment and he says, just don't think about it. You won't understand. You'll just get the wrong idea. Just don't think about it. And elsewhere in the Udana, so elsewhere in the same work, he elaborates on this theme in the parable of the elephant. How many people have heard the parable of the elephant? Okay, a few, not everybody. So, in this story, a king decides to have some fun. In a rather cruel way, I always think. But anyway, he decides to have some fun by rounding up a handful of blind men and allowing them to touch an elephant. So one of these men is allowed to get hold of the trunk of the elephant, and another one is allowed to touch the leg, and another one gets hold of the tail, and another one gets the ears, or one of the ears. And these men have never experienced an elephant before. They don't know what an elephant is. And having been allowed a limited access to this elephant, they're all asked to describe what an elephant is. So the one that's been allowed to handle the trunk says the elephant is a huge snake. The one that's been allowed to hold the leg says the elephant is a great tree trunk. The one that held the ear says the elephant is a fan, and so on, you can imagine. I mean, there's lots of different answers to what an elephant is, depending on what it is that you touched when you were allowed to touch the elephant. So in other words, each of them decides that the elephant is something that he already knows, because it's incredibly difficult to imagine something, to conceive of something that you just don't know. And because we only have our past experience to build on, that's what we tend to do when we think about enlightenment. We tend to try to make it into something we already know. And the Buddha knew that was a tendency. He knew that was a danger. So he didn't often talk about it. So actually, this bit of the Udana is a bit special. It's an occasion when the Buddha actually agreed to talk about this subject. And his followers are particularly attentive when he agrees to do it, as we'll see if we just have a look at this first introduction to section 8 of the Udana. So it says, on that occasion, the Lord was staying at Sarvati, in an Arthur Pindaker's park in Jetta's Grove. And on that occasion, the Lord had been indicating Nibbana to the monks with Dharma talk that was connected with Nibbana, making them take it up, making them keen, making them bristle with excitement, whilst the monks had been listening with attentive ear, making it their goal, paying attention, concentrating their whole minds. So you get, I mean, you really get the idea. This is something special. This is not just one of the, you know, and then the Buddha said. This is, well, you know, the monks are all really excited about this because he doesn't often talk about this. And the verses that follow that are particularly well known, and you'll find them quoted often. You've got them printed on the handout, and here is the first. This is the Buddha describing enlightenment. Then the Lord, fathoming this matter, gave rise to this udana, this utterance. Monks, there is a condition where there is no earth, water, fire, or air, no base of infinite space, no ground of infinite consciousness, no sphere of nothingness, no realm of neither perception nor non-perception, where there is neither this world nor a world beyond, neither here nor there, no sun, no moon. So, monks, I say there is no coming, no going, no staying, no deceasing, no arising. It is unfixed, yet also immovable, unimaginable beyond all conceptions, and freed from conditioned supports. This, indeed, is the end of suffering. Okay, so that's the first of them, the first verse. So what's the Buddha saying here? First of all, he said, monks, there is a condition where there is no earth, water, fire, or air. So he's saying here that there's a state that is nothing like the material world. The material world consists of the four elements, earth, water, fire, air. So there is a state that's nothing to do with those. Then he says, there's no base of infinite consciousness. Sorry, no base of infinite space, no ground of infinite consciousness, no sphere of nothingness, no realm of neither perception nor non-perception. Those four lines will be familiar to advanced meditators. They're actually a description of the four most advanced meditative states, the four formless dhyanas. And well, what the Buddha's saying here is that enlightenment, the unconditioned, is not like meditative states. These advanced meditative states are pretty good, but they aren't enlightenment. So then he says, where there is neither this world nor a world beyond. So he's saying it's not this world and it's not a heavenly world. It's not this world, it's not another world. It's neither here nor there, so it's not a place at all. It's beyond space. No sun nor moon. So, monks, I say, there's no coming, no going, no staying, no deceasing, no arising. And I think here he's saying, well, it's not in time either. So we're out of space, from the last line, and here he's saying, well, it's not about time either. It's outside of time. There's no sun or the moon, and the sun and the moon are how we kind of measure night and day. There's no staying, deceasing, arising, and so on. That means that things aren't changing. If they're not changing, then we're not in time, because that's how we measure time. We measure time through change. So what is it? What is the unconditioned? What is enlightenment? So the Buddha, I think, is trying to describe that in the last few lines of this verse. He says, at the end, he says, it is the end of suffering. So that's quite reassuring. It's unimaginable beyond all conceptions. So in a way, it's not surprising that we don't have a clear idea of it. Here the Buddha is saying we won't be able to imagine it. And it's free of conditioned supports. So that means it's not like the conditioned world that we know. It's not relying on conditions. So it's completely different from anything in our experience. But the interesting thing, for me at any rate, is that he's not saying there's nothing. He's saying there's no sun, there's no moon, there's no this, there's no that. And it's very easy to follow that logic to a mistaken idea that enlightenment just means the end of everything. But the Buddha quite clearly, at the beginning of this verse, says there is a condition, which he has to describe in negative terms because there are no words that can really describe it. But there is something, there is a condition. And actually, the second of the very famous verses emphasises this, I think, in no uncertain terms. So going on to the second of the verses that you've got here in your handout, he says, "Monks, there is an unborn, an unbecome, an uncreated, an unconditioned. Monks, if there were no unborn, no unbecome, no uncreated, no unconditioned, then there would be no escape from the rounds of rebirth, becoming, recreation, and conditioned existence. Yet since there is an unborn, an unbecome, an uncreated, and an unconditioned, know that escape is possible from the rounds of rebirth, becoming, recreation, and conditioned existence." So that's pretty unequivocal. The Buddha is saying that there is an unconditioned state, that enlightenment isn't just nothing. It isn't anything like conditioned existence that we're familiar with, but it does actually exist. So, how does that grab you? To me, the whole thing is incredibly puzzling, but really, really exciting. I was actually thrilled the first time I read these two verses, and actually I'm so excited every time I reread it. I think that this is the most important thing you're going to hear today, or even this week, or even in your entire life, actually. It means that there's something more than the conditioned world that we know. And the something more is not simply nothing. But okay, it is a bit confusing. Here we have the Buddha talking about the goal of a spiritual life, and it's very difficult to understand. To help us understand, Buddhists have been discussing, debating, and writing for 2.5 millennia. And that's a lot of reading, and most of it isn't very easy. And even if you studied all of it, it wouldn't necessarily make you enlightened. Because enlightenment is an experience and not a concept. It's a spiritual experience, not an intellectual idea. It's very enticing what the Buddha says about it, the unconditioned, but it's still a bit abstract. I think that we need to be able to imagine our goal a bit more clearly than that, really. To see or hear or smell at least a hint of it. I think it's important that we've got something to aim for that will really get our juices flowing. Something that we'll really want. So we might think about, so how might we think about our goal in a spiritual life? So there are many ways of thinking about the goal of the spiritual life. The ones we've already mentioned, enlightenment and the unconditioned. But there's also Bodhi, Nirvana, some of you will have heard of that, or Nibbana as it's sometimes called. There's Shunyata, or emptiness, liberation, the deathless, the end of suffering, the pure land, and I could go on actually, there are quite a lot of other names too. And what I'm going to do in the rest of this talk is to just look at a few of the main models for the unconditioned that might help us to think about our goal. And I should start by saying that these all come with a health warning. Don't think that if you've understood the model, then you've got it. Because the Buddha says, if you remember, that enlightenment is beyond all conceptions. But you can use these ideas as a kind of short-term goal. You can use them a bit like the horizon that you see when you set off to climb a new hill. You know the top that you can see isn't actually the top, but it's as far as you can see. And then you kind of get to that top that you can see, and when you've got there, you can see another top somewhere beyond. And that might be the top of the hill, or it might just be another summit partway up the mountain, and the next thing you do is to make for that one. And in a way, that's how you need to use these models. So firstly, we'll explore the one that the Buddha uses in the Udana, the unconditioned. Or perhaps more helpfully, we could call it release from conditioned existence. So, One of the most basic teachings of Buddhism, probably the most important in the sense of being key to all the others, is the teaching that Vedanya talked about last week when he talked about conditioned co-production, or pratityasamutpada. And that is summed up in a pithy phrase, which is on the block of wood, which is just on Vedanya's left at the moment, which we had up here last week. I think the translation I'm going to read is slightly different from that, but it's the same thing, really. All things arise dependent on conditions and will pass away when conditions cease. Okay, so this is going back to everything that we know is dependent on conditions. And it's one of those simple teachings that is just incredibly, incredibly profound. Everything that you can think of, or that I can think of, has come into being because of conditions. Our bodies, our thoughts, our emotions, our possessions, this center, the ideas that we're discussing, everything. And actually, we are limited by our conditions and our conditioning. The way we act, the way we think, the way we talk are all conditioned by our past, by our biology, our gender, our society, our surroundings, our families, our colleagues, our friends, the things that happen to us, and so on and so on. I could go on forever. Everything is just a whole, huge, interconnected whole, and everything affects everything else. So the Buddha is saying here that enlightenment is free of conditioned support. It's not dependent on conditions. And it's just impossible for us to imagine what that must be like. But the Buddha is being pretty plain about some of the implications. He says that escape is possible from the rounds of rebirth, becoming, recreation, and conditioned experience. Whether you regard rebirth as a metaphor or a reality, actually, the Buddha is saying that this is the end of cycling round on the wheel of life, of falling into the same old habits, getting the same old unsatisfactory results. He says, this is the end of suffering. He says, this is the end of death. So imagine, just for a moment, what it would be like to be free of just that one habit that you would really, really like to break. Okay, or that one emotional state that you would really rather never experience again. Just imagine what that would be like. And then just try to grow that imagining into being completely free of all conditions and all conditioning. Completely and utterly free. So actually it might be easier for us to relate to this kind of goal when we're experiencing suffering, or remembering a time when life was difficult or sad, if we can contact the dread that we feel about losing someone or something that's really, really important to us, or the pain of regretting what we've done or said. Enlightenment is the end, it's the lack of that sort of suffering. Put positively, it's the end of everything that's wrong with the conditioned world that we know. It's something really wonderful. So inexplicably wonderful that it can only be hinted at in metaphors. Later in the Udanas, the Buddha described it as the farther shore beyond a raging river. Elsewhere, he likens it to a cool cave, which I think is a metaphor that probably works better in India's climate than ours. He describes it also as an isle and as a wonderful stretch of level ground, which is also a more suitable metaphor for someone who's travelled a lot in the foothills of the Himalayas than for people living in present-day Britain. But, you know, these are all metaphors to kind of point at something which is, well, it's wonderful beyond imagination, really. And Sangharachitta reminds us that the mind, which is unconditioned, is intensely and radiantly alive. Above all, he said, it is creative. And his description of it in mind, reactive and creative is one that can act, I think, as a real motivator. He says, the optimism of the creative mind persists despite unpleasant stimuli. It loves where there is no reason to love. It is happy where there is no reason for happiness. Creates where there is no possibility of creativity. And in this way, builds a heaven in hell's despair. So just going beyond conditioned existence sounds like a pretty good goal to me. And that's the first of the ways of looking at the goal of the spiritual life. So the second goal is nirvana, or nibbana, as it's called in the Pali Canon. And this is the model of the unconditioned that is commonest in Theravadan or Southeast Asian Buddhism. They tend to talk about nirvana. And nirvana literally means extinguishing of a fire. So actually that sounds a bit scary to me. Does it really mean that like a fire we go out at enlightenment? And if so, it's hard to imagine a deadlier image for a spiritual goal, just utter annihilation. And this nihilist idea of nirvana has been taken pretty literally by some Western scholars, and also by Christians seeking to undermine Buddhism, I suspect. But it isn't really what the Buddha intended at all. He even, in his lifetime, refuted that idea quite strongly. And this mistaken idea about nirvana is based on a misunderstanding about how Indians of the Buddha's time thought about fire. Apparently, Indians at the time saw fire when it's burning, as agitated, dependent, trapped, clinging to and stuck to the fuel that it was burning. They believed that when a fire was extinguished, it let go of its fuel and was freed. It was released. It was released from its agitation and dependence and entrapment, and it became diffused throughout the cosmos and became calm and unconfined. And apparently, Pali poetry repeatedly uses the image of the extinguished fire as a metaphor for freedom, and that's exactly how the Buddha was using it. So the word nirvana implies freedom from what agitates and traps us, freedom from the wanting and not wanting that keeps us stuck to our surroundings and our habits, freedom from suffering and death, freedom to be calm and unconfined, to enjoy peace, bliss, and expansive states of mind. So that's nirvana, that's the second model for the goal of the spiritual life. Third model is the spiritual goal of emptiness, or shunyata. And I'm sure you'll have heard a lot about this one. It's quite a common goal that's stated for the goal of the spiritual path, the goal of the Buddhist path. But actually that can seem like a pretty nihilistic goal for the spiritual life as well, that what you're aiming for is emptiness. Probably more has been written and discussed about emptiness than any other model of the unconditioned, which is pretty amusing when you think about it. There are schools of Buddhism that disagree strongly about the finer philosophical points of what is meant by emptiness. Monks used to have long debates about it. One school of Buddhism defines 35 different types of emptiness. And Sangharakshita's got this amusing story about a particular Indian official who used to spend hours and hours, day after day, in discussion with the abbot of a local monastery. And when Sangharakshita asked him what they were discussing, he discovered they were talking about emptiness. So what does shunyata or emptiness mean? Basically, it means emptiness of any permanent self-existence. It's based on the fact that we are, and everything we know, is conditioned and therefore transient, impermanent. Nothing exists of itself. Everything we know, everything in conditioned existence, comes into being dependent upon conditions and then ceases when the conditions are no longer there. So the goal of the spiritual life is not to become shunyata, but to realize it. Because in realizing it, we realize how things really are, which is completely and beautifully interconnected. Realizing shunyata, or emptiness, means seeing reality in all its scintillating glory, experiencing things as they really are. So while nirvana is the usual goal of the Theravadan tradition, shunyata is most often associated with the Mahayana. In part, it arose as a reaction to the idea that the goal of the spiritual life should be personal freedom. By stressing interconnectedness, Mahayanists provide a goal which is both attractive and altruistic. If everything is interconnected, we aren't going for personal liberation. We're aiming to get everything and everyone, all of the interconnected whole, life, the universe and everything, enlightened. And that, of course, becomes the Bodhisattva ideal. Bodhisattvas work at realizing emptiness or realizing shunyata so that they can lead all beings to the same blissful goal. And in case you think we're straying a bit here from the Udana, which is after all a Pali text, on which the Theravadins base their practice, let me read you two lines from the less well-known verse that comes in between the two that you've got on your handout. One translation for this reads, "For one who sees, naught remains." And another translation of it says, "He who has insight holds to nothing whatever."